You sent us a truly fascinating stack of theoretical papers and research notes for today's mission.
Oh, it is a dense stack.
It really is.
Oh, yeah.
But the objective here is to dismantle two concepts that are constantly, and I mean constantly, mistakenly conflated in our modern discourse, and those are fairness and equity.
Right.
We're doing a deep dive into this foundational theoretical text you provided, which analyzes competing ethical theories of distribution. And the stakes for you, the listener, are remarkably high. I mean, we experience values like fairness and equity viscerally, right?
Absolutely. You know when you feel it.
Exactly. But we are rapidly moving into this era where those deeply human, kind of gut-feeling values, they have to be defined mathematically.
And that is the critical threshold we're crossing right now. I mean, consider the real-world dilemma of a social media algorithm. Let's use Facebook ad distribution as our primary example today.
Okay, that makes sense.
If an algorithm is tasked with distributing advertisements for a really highly lucrative, say, six-figure job opportunity, how do we define the ethical parameters of who actually sees that ad? You can't just instruct a machine to be, quote-unquote, good.
Right, or fair.
Exactly, because an algorithm doesn't have a moral compass. It only understands code. So you have to define the mathematical variables of that goodness with absolute rigorous precision.
Because you can't just write a line of code that says, do the right thing. You have to actually tell the system what the right thing mathematically is.
Yes.
And in the literature you sent us, the authors point out that before you write a single line of code, you have to make this fundamental, almost philosophical choice. And I kept seeing these two massive academic terms in your notes, deontological and
Oh,
teleological.
no, they sound incredibly intimidating.
They really do. So let's unpack this. What do those actually mean when we're talking about programming an algorithm?
It's actually a very straightforward division once you get past the jargon. It boils down to this: are you optimizing for a deontological process or a teleological outcome?
Okay.
If you choose a deontological process,
Yes.
which is what aligns with the concept of fairness, you're saying that the rules must be strictly followed, impartially, no matter what the final result looks like. The process itself is the only thing that matters.
So the steps you take.
Right. But if you choose a teleological outcome, which aligns with equity, you're saying that the final result is the only thing that matters.
I see.
You decide what the end state should look like, even if you have to bend or manipulate those procedural rules to get there. Algorithms require you to pick one. They just cannot operate in a space of philosophical
They
ambiguity.
need a binary choice. So we're here to analyze and dissect the logic of these two models. And your sources suggest we need to go back to the philosophical bedrock to do that.
We really do.
Let's start with fairness. The texts trace this all the way back to ancient Greece, specifically to Aristotle. How did he define it?
The Aristotelian definition of fairness is elegant in its simplicity, but it's incredibly rigid. It dictates that equals must be treated equally, and proportionately, unequals must be treated unequally.
Okay, so just to make sure I have this, if two people do the exact same amount of work, they get the exact same pay, equals treated equally.
Precisely. The core logic of this framework is that the process justifies the outcome. This is that deontological approach we just talked about.
Right.
If the procedural rules of distribution are applied without bias, and the starting line is the exact same, whatever outcome is generated by that system is philosophically justified. Therefore, equality applies strictly to opportunities.
Opportunities. Which means within this framework, we're primarily concerned with verbs. It's about action.
That is a great way to think about it. Yes,
Right.
fairness is inextricably linked to what you do, your actions, your performance in the world. You perform action, you win a competition, you produce a product, and therefore you merit the reward based purely on that verb.
And what does society look like under this Aristotelian model? Because it seems like it would be very decentralized.
It is entirely decentralized. Society, in the context of fairness, is viewed merely as a collection of autonomous individuals. The individual is the supreme key here.
Okay.
The logic follows that if you treat individuals ethically, which is to say, fairly and impartially, according to their actions, the subsequent society that naturally emerges from millions of those interactions is inherently good. You don't manage the society, you manage the rules for the individual.
That makes a lot of sense. But then we fast forward to the 20th century and we hit the framework of equity, which your notes show is heavily informed by the philosopher John Rawls.
Yes, Rawls is central to this.
And Rawls basically flips the entire Aristotelian script totally on its head. Under his theory, the distributive mandate is that the greatest advantage must be distributed to the least advantaged. So how does he change the math?
He inverts it completely.
Mm-hmm.
In equity, the outcome justifies the process. This is the teleological approach.
Right, the out-
you decide on the desired end state, say, a society where no one is left behind, and you manipulate the procedural mechanics, however you need to achieve that state. Equality, therefore, applies to the final outcome, not the initial opportunity.
So if fairness is about verbs, equity has to be fundamentally concerned with nouns.
Exactly. It focuses on nouns, who you are, your starting position, your innate characteristics, or your group identity. The distribution of resources or opportunities is based on your classification.
The noun.
The noun, rather than your performance, the verb. If a person belongs to a demographic group that is statistically falling behind, they receive a targeted unequal advantage based on that identity in order to correct the final outcome.
Which means the view of society shifts dramatically here. We aren't just a collection of autonomous individuals anymore under Rawls.
Not at all. Under an equity framework, individuals are viewed as aspects of a larger, pre-existing societal structure. An ideal vision of society is established first, and that vision dictates exactly how individuals must be treated to achieve it. Inclusiveness, the mandate of leaving absolutely no one behind, becomes the supreme key.
Even if it overrides individual performance.
Even if it overrides individual performance, yes.
Here's where it gets really interesting for you listening, because the sources provide some fantastic real-world analogies to illustrate these competing paradigms. Let's look at how they operate in our daily lives. The paradigmatic case for fairness is professional sports or the Olympics.
The Olympics is the perfect example.
Right. When you sit down to watch the 100-meter dash, you want the absolute best performer to win. The procedural process is identical for every single athlete. They all start at the exact same line at the exact same time to the sound of the exact same starting gun.
And crucially, no one receives a head start based on their historical training disadvantages.
Mm.
If one runner had inferior coaching or less access to good nutrition growing up, the Olympic committee does not move their starting block forward to compensate.
They just don't.
No. The verb, the act of running on that specific day, determines the value and the reward. The blind process justifies the outcome, even if one runner is left entirely in the dust.
But then we shift to the paradigmatic case for equity, which the texts argue is the family unit. Most families operate daily on the principle of distributing the greatest advantage to the least advantaged. And the notes used a golf analogy that I thought was absolutely brilliant.
I love that analogy.
Right. If you apply the sports scenario to a family playing golf, the rules change entirely.
They have to. I mean, if a young child plays golf against adults and you apply strict Aristotelian fairness, the child's going to lose miserably.
You'd probably end up in peers.
Exactly. So what does the family do? The child is given free strokes. The process is deliberately manipulated. They might be given 3, 5, 10 free strokes. The exact number is irrelevant.
Right.
What matters is that the procedural process is repeatedly adjusted until the scores equalize at the end of the hole.
And you see this in household chores, too. If one parent has a terrible, exhausting day at work, the other parent steps in and cooks dinner, even if it wasn't their turn.
Yes.
There is no ledger. There's no scorecard on the fridge tracking who cooked last week to ensure a strict 50-50 division of labor. The system is designed entirely around providing maximum assistance to the person currently experiencing the least advantage.
And this philosophical divergence becomes starkly apparent when we strip away the analogies and translate it into pure mathematical probabilities, because this is exactly what algorithmic engineers have to grapple with.
Okay, let's get into the math.
Consider a highly simplified dilemma distributing exactly $100 between two people. If we program an algorithm to optimize for fairness, the mathematical solution is a single coin flip.
Heads, I win, tails, you win.
Exactly. The winner takes the full $100. The process is mathematically flawless and perfectly impartial. Neither person was given an unfair advantage. However, look at the outcome. Absolute inequality.
Right. One person walks away with $100 and the other person is left entirely behind with nothing.
So if we optimize that same algorithm for equity, the mathematics have to change entirely. We aren't doing one coin flip anymore.
No, because a single coin flip allows for a catastrophic failure for one party. To achieve equity, we move from one coin flip for $100 to 100 individual coin flips for $1 each.
Yes.
Ah, because the laws of probability mandate a regression to the mean.
Precisely. You might win the first flip and the second and maybe even the third. But over the course of 100 iterations, the statistical variance shrinks dramatically.
It evens out.
It evens out. you continually iterate the process until the outcome sits at approximately $50 for each person. The algorithmic process is intentionally stretched, diluted, and manipulated to guarantee that the final outcome is equalized and no one is left behind.
Which brings us to a critical theoretical conflict in the literature you provided. It's known as the Wilt-Chamberlain thought experiment. And just a quick note for you as we dive into this part, we are strictly playing the role of impartial messengers here.
Very important point.
Yeah, we are not endorsing Nozick's libertarian viewpoints or Rawls' redistributive viewpoints. We are exclusively analyzing the structural logic of their arguments, mapping out how the math works in their respective philosophies.
It's an important distinction to make because these arguments evoke really strong reactions. The setup for this thought experiment originates from Robert Nozick, who was actually a colleague of John Rawls at Harvard in the 1970s. Nozick formulated this scenario as a direct mathematical rebuttal to Rawls' theory of equity.
Okay, so set the stage for us. Nozick asks us to imagine a society where absolute equity has actually been achieved, right?
Correct. Imagine society has successfully implemented Rawls' vision. Everyone starts the year with the exact same amount of wealth.
Yeah.
Total equality. Then the economic system opens up for the year. Wilt Chamberlain, who was a massive generational superstar in the NBA at the time, negotiates a very specific contract.
Okay.
He stipulates that every fan who voluntarily attends a home game must drop an extra 25 cents into a special bucket that goes directly to him.
And the fans gladly pay this. They want to watch a superstar. It's like fans flocking to see Michael Jordan or LeBron James. They are thrilled to hand over their quarters.
Exactly. So we fast forward to the end of the basketball season. Because millions of people watched him play, Wilt Chamberlain is now vastly wealthier than any other citizen.
Right.
We suddenly have a society with severe wealth inequality. Now, the structural logic of the fairness or libertarian conclusion operates as follows. Nozick argues that this resultant inequality is mathematically and philosophically fair.
Because everyone had an equal opportunity.
Yes. Every single fan parted with their 25 cents voluntarily. Zero coercion was involved. Furthermore, anyone else in that society had the equal opportunity to become a great basketball player and negotiate a similar contract.
I see.
Because the procedural mechanism was entirely uncoerced and equal in opportunity, Nozick argues the resulting societal inequality is entirely justified. The blind, fair process justifies the unequal outcome.
But John Rawls, representing the equity conclusion, rejects this logic entirely. If no one was forced to pay the quarter, what is Rawls' problem with the outcome?
For Rawls, the purpose of a just society is not merely to provide an uncoerced opportunity to get ahead. The fundamental purpose of a just society is to ensure that no one is left behind.
Huh.
Therefore, equity dictates that the final outcome, Chamberlain hoarding a massive disproportionate percentage of the society's wealth while others return to the baseline, is mathematically unacceptable, regardless of how voluntary the process was.
So how does Rawls propose fixing it?
To correct this, Chamberlain must be heavily taxed. The wealth must be forcibly extracted from him and redistributed back to the least advantaged members of society to restore that equitable baseline. For Rawls, achieving the desired inclusive outcome justifies overriding the uncoerced process.
The literature you sent us frequently utilizes visual thought experiments to map out these ethical criteria because it can get incredibly dense. The most prominent one in your notes is the visualization of three people attempting to watch a sports game over a tall wooden fence.
Yes, it's a classic illustration. We have three individuals of different heights, one tall, one middle height, and one very short. And we have three wooden boxes available to distribute to help them see over the fence.
Okay, let's run through the scenarios. Scenario one, we apply a system that is fair, but not equitable.
In this scenario, we distribute exactly one box to each person. Equals treated equally. The tall person and the middle person stand on their boxes and can easily see the game. However, the short person, even standing on their one proportionally fair box, still cannot see over the tall fence. The blind process leaves the least advantage behind.
Scenario two, we apply a system that is both fair and equitable.
Now the distribution changes. The shortest person receives two boxes, the middle person receives one box, and the tallest person receives zero boxes. The result is a perfectly level viewing field. All three individuals can see the game.
Now, in the notes, the author spent a lot of time on this specific scenario. Why is this middle option so confusing in the academic literature?
What's fascinating here is the theoretical overlap. This exact intersection is why academic literature on this subject is often incredibly hazy.
How so?
Well, it is clearly equitable, because the greatest advantage to two boxes was distributed to the least advantage, the shortest person. But it is also technically fair under the strict Aristotelian definition, because unequals are being treated proportionately unequally. The shortest and the tallest are physically unequal regarding the task of seeing over the fence. So distributing the boxes unequally satisfies that specific interpretation of fairness. The philosophical logic leading to the outcome is entirely different, but the final visual happens to match both criteria perfectly.
Which brings us to scenario three, a system that is equitable, but not fair.
To visualize this, we alter the scenario slightly. Imagine the tallest person is now so tall that giving boxes to the shortest person isn't enough. You actually have to take away the ground beneath the tallest person to make them equal.
Wow, okay.
The shortest people get maximum help, but it results in a scenario where the tallest person is now the absolute only individual who cannot see the game. They are effectively penalized for their innate physical advantage in order to maximize the position of the previously disadvantaged.
Your stack of sources actually compresses these four criteria even further by applying them to a microscopic scale, which they call the cookie matrix. I loved this part. It's two people, one cookie.
It's an excellent distillation. If the distribution must be both fair and equitable, you simply break the cookie perfectly in half. Equals are treated equally, and the greatest advantage is given to the least advantaged because as one person takes a bite, their hunger decreases, shifting the status of least advantage to the other person. You alternate bites until both are full.
Okay, what if the distribution must be fair but not equitable?
You implement a strict lottery. You flip a single coin for the entire cookie. The process is completely impartial, but one person goes entirely hungry.
And here is my favorite one. What if the distribution must be not fair, but equitable?
The logic dictates that the person who overslept and missed breakfast automatically gets the entire cookie.
Wait, so the guy who hit snooze 3 times and completely failed his morning routine gets rewarded with 100% of the cookie.
It sounds absolutely crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The sheer irony is profound. A person is literally rewarded with a treat for sleeping in simply because their current biological state of hunger classifies them at this exact moment as the least advantage.
That's wild.
It is a total violation of process-based fairness. They didn't earn it, but it is a perfect, flawless execution of outcome-based equity.
And finally, a distribution that is neither fair nor equitable.
That is simply cheating. A third party enters the room and seals the cookie.
When we pull back from these philosophical models, whether it's Wilt Chamberlain's quarters or the cookie matrix, and we return to the algorithmic reality, the complexity of this mathematical translation becomes genuinely daunting. Let's go back to that Facebook ad distribution algorithm for a high-paying tech job.
Right.
The code you write must enforce one of these realities. You have to choose. Do you code for Nozick's fairness?
If you do, it requires a completely blind deontological process. Every single user on the platform must have the exact same statistical probability of having that job ad render in their feed, regardless of their demographic background, their zip code, or their historical disadvantages. The math is blind.
Or do you code for Rawls equity?
Which requires a teleological process. You calculate the historical disadvantages of specific demographic groups, and you mathematically force the algorithm to inject the high-paying job ad into the feeds of those specific groups at a massively disproportionate rate. You actively manipulate the statistical process to guarantee an equalized socioeconomic outcome.
And the machine cannot execute both simultaneously in a purely binary system. It requires an active, conscious choice by the programmer between competing ethical values.
Which forces a confrontation with this profound reality. If we connect this to the bigger picture, imagine you are the architect of a medical triage algorithm. You are tasked with distributing vastly limited life-saving resources, say, a scarce medication or ventilators, during a catastrophic global event.
A terrifying scenario.
It is. Do you code for absolute fairness? Do you build a strict blind lottery where every single patient, regardless of their underlying health or age, has an equal randomized statistical chance at survival, even if it means the most historically vulnerable are left behind to die?
Or do you code for absolute equity?
Do you program the system to prioritize the sickest and most vulnerable patients first, even if the mathematical modeling guarantees that the currently healthiest patients will deteriorate and suffer as a result? You cannot have both, which logic rules your code.